Okay, thank you for people on Zoom. Thank you for people who are here. We're going to talk about today the part two in the in our series about American Judaism, United or Divided. We're going to talk about the attempted merger of JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and REITS, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary. And we're going to give a large introduction till we get to the topic itself to understand the landscape. And just as a beginning, there is often a tension between the desire for unity to create standards, because the advantage of unity is that it creates standards. Unity creates strength in numbers. And sometimes for the sake of shalom, we believe in peace. Peace is a good Jewish value. However, on the other side, we sometimes want to promote our own positions. And we feel stronger about our own positions, and there, herein lies the conflict between the desire for unity and the feeling like I want to go my own path. There's also often a tension between the need to have standards for institutions with the reality that if someone doesn't like the standards, then he or she may simply leave. And then, of course, there's the challenge of freedom and choice when it comes to religious observance. In Europe, everyone was forced to belong to a singular synagogue community, often with a singular rabbinical figure. America is the land of the free, and there is freedom to exercise my religion as I choose, and the state will not get involved in religious disputes. Therefore, the Jewish community transformed itself from being a synagogue community to a community of synagogues, each one trying to attract the modern American Jew. Attempts, though, to create standards and unity and strengthen numbers in the middle of the 19th century. First, there was Rabbi Isaac Leiser, who then by moderate Orthodox and reformers, before there was an understanding that that there is now an enormous gap at the end of the 19th century between these two movements. And then when Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss thinks that reform has won, so then he wants to create unity in saying the American Jewish community is basically reform standards. However, by the 1880s, this is a little chazar, a little review from the last lecture, when the reform movement thought it had won, it came to realize that that was not the case because it had gone too far for some, opening the door for what was to be known as conservative Judaism. Additionally, pogroms break out in 1881 in Russia, sending millions of Jews to America over the next 45 years, which radically changes the landscape of Judaism in this country. And the Orthodox, we weren't giving up. We built schools and yeshivos and eventually rabbinic seminaries at this time. But at this point, no longer were the Orthodox considered a unified laity and rabbinic leadership with the Reform movement. But the question is, that we're going to discuss today, what about the conservative movement? Like, Reform movement, we said there's no chance we can find common ground. What about the conservative movement? Those Jews who walked out of the Treifa banquet in 1883, celebrating the first graduating class of Hebrew Union College, is there something to talk about between the Orthodox and the conservative movement? So the question is, what about those Jews who thought that the reforms advocated by the Reform movement went too far? Could there be hope of unity between the new conservative movement and the Orthodox movement in America? This is what I hope to discuss today during this lecture. So there was mass immigration, approximately 2 million East European Jews from Russia, Romania, Austria, Hungary migrate to the United States between 1881 and 1914. And this added, there basically were about 280,000 Jews in America in 1880. So obviously it's a major change, a major difference, like almost tenfold increase between 1880 and 1914. Now for Jews, pogroms were a major cause of migration, as was overpopulation, oppressive legislation, forced conscriptions, and economics and poverty. This began with the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881, followed by a series of pogroms that attacked 169 Jewish communities and destroyed 20,000 Jewish homes. In 1882, the May laws forced Jews back into crowded villages of what's called the Pale of Jewish Settlement, So there were more repressive rules. And the question is, where should the Jews emigrate? Eretz Yisrael was one option, and America was, those are the two major options. Some decide to move to Argentina, South Africa, but the biggest two considerations were this kind of fledgling community in Eretz Yisrael or America. Now, proponents of Eretz Yisrael claim that every diaspora has always been a disaster, right? So therefore, Eretz Yisrael, we got to go there. Proponents of America claim that America was different than every other diaspora. That's the big question today, right? There are people who basically say at some point in the future, we're going to have to leave America. And others say, no, America is different. That's like always the big question. Yeah?
The major difference was every other diaspora until then, whether it's both England, Germany, France, we were forced by the host country to have somewhere else.
Right.
The entire community went, grabbed my hand, went, as one unit to the new country, and when they landed, they were ready to start doing everything because the rabbi was there, the mole was there. In this case, the explosion was generated by us. We went to the United States. They didn't say, they weren't, the United States wasn't asked, do you accept us? Because we as a community, not even as people, not even as communities, went on our own to the United States.
Right, we didn't go as communities, that's correct.
We didn't go as community, went, and worked with the rabbis who were with us so that when we landed,
right, we came before the rabbis. Yes, that is correct. That was already in the 1800s. But this what I'm saying is though, the question was from what is America simply like another country that will be good for a while and will turn against us, or maybe there were those who argued that America was different, that America's unique history and the liberal constitution distinguished it from other diaspora havens where Jews settled. And in America, Jews would finally be able to realize the great enlightenment goals that they had sought for 2,000 years. Now, America wins out. 80% goes to the United States, and 3% goes to Eretz Yisrael. And the reason, because at the end of the day, economics make a major determining factor. Eretz Yisrael was a major economic disaster. Now, most Jews who came to America passed through the port of New York. Many of them stayed in New York because of the abundant economic opportunities, especially in the fast-growing clothing trade. And also, it's great comfort. There are a lot of Yiddish-speaking Jews nearby. The general press labeled September 9th, 1881, as the precise date when the mass migration of East European Jews began. The first group of 18 pogrom refugees arrived in New York then. In New York, there were 84,000 Jews in 1874. And then, about 40 years later, in 1915, they go from 84,000 to 1.4 million. It's okay. So it's 28% of the New York population. Between 1908 and 1914, the rate of return of migration for Jews was 7.1% for Jews. They are migrating a lot. Now, some East European leading Orthodox Jews, certain leading East European Orthodox rabbis opposed immigration to the United States. The most forceful opponent was probably the Chafetz Chaim. He advised that individuals should not move there because, as I'm sure we've heard, right, danger to the soul. However, some rabbis were not so opposed. For example, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, right, the founder of the Musar movement, he has said to have sanctioned emigration to America. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector of Kovna offered to send his own son in 1887 to serve as New York's chief rabbi. Young people eager to make a fresh start in life and to avoid the Tsar's army, poor individuals and those for whom religious climate wasn't so important were more inclined to move to America than the opposite kind of people, as the case may be. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the stories of how immigrants already ate non-kosher. As soon as they get on the boat, you know, they're already eating non-kosher food on the boat to the United States. Or they throw away their talitot and tefillin in the Atlantic Ocean, or they didn't perform until Tilash Adayim or recite Birkas Hamazon in their first meal in New York at the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society's kosher facility in Ellis Island. They have these stories. As soon as they leave their little shelter, so then they throw away religion. One historian pointed out that out of the approximately 200 congregations in existence in the United States at the time of the Great Migration, only about a dozen were still Orthodox. Okay? And that by 1906, 91% of the Russian Jewish immigrants ceased to be strictly Orthodox in their religious practices. Now that might be an over-exaggeration, but the numbers are really bad for the Orthodox. There was only one Talmud Torah of any merit on the entire east side of New York in 1887, Machzike Talmud Torah. In 1888, it had 690 boys and 8 teachers, and there were only 2 Jewish day schools in the whole country until 1915. And there are basically 3 different types of immigrant types. You had your first type, who comes to America, and they are learned and pious Jews, and they try to transplant East European practices and institutions to the United States, notwithstanding the challenges. They took less well-paying jobs in order to keep Shabbos, so they might teach Hebrew. Some of them changed as they got older, others did not, yet many of them did not actually expect their children who attended public schools and played with non-observant Jews to follow in their footsteps. A second type of Jew who immigrated to the United States was known as the mover and shaker. In Yiddish, I hope I pronounced right, the Schwitzer. Yeah, is that right? Okay. This one comes to the United States to make a fortune. They shamelessly abandoned their faith. Few cases they intermarried. The goal was to make money, and it's all about the American dream. The third was the free-thinking radical. He comes to the United States with a predetermined social agenda. These were revolutionaries in Eastern Europe, and they advocated far-reaching social, political, economic changes. Now, most Jews from Eastern Europe combine elements of each of these types. They struggled to find this kind of balance between their ancient faith, economic aspirations, and this utopian ideologies. Now, from an Orthodox standpoint, this immigration marked the third of the 3 waves of immigrations of Jews to the United States. The first, wave of immigration was in the more like austere and pomp-ridden Sephardic Orthodoxy that moved from Holland and England in the 16th, 17th, and early 18th centuries. The second wave was the dignified, intellectualized Orthodoxy of Germany in the mid-19th century. And the third was now the Talmud-oriented, ghetto-minded, East European brand from Poland, Galicia, Russia, and Hungary from the end of the 19th century. Just kind of try to perspective different ways of Jews who moved in. Now, there's a spiritual crisis going on in America at this time, because the American situation was very different than the East European situation. In Eastern Europe, religion defined Jews. Jews were taxed as Jews. They were drafted into the army as Jews. Their religious affiliation was stamped on their passport. When they were married or divorced, it was done only according to Jewish law. The state recognized Judaism as a minority faith, and those who sought to cast off Judaism could only do so if they converted. In the United States, though, obviously it's very different. Religion is purely private and voluntary and totally outside the state's domain. Rabbis enjoy no official status at all in the United States, and Judaism was easy to abandon. And because of economics, it was difficult to observe scrupulously. Very few rabbis immigrate to the United States in the 1880s and 1890s. There was one rabbi, Moshe Weinberger. He was one of the rabbis who immigrated, not the current rabbi Moshe Weinberger, they should call this, but one of the rabbis back then in the 1880s who did immigrate, claimed in 1887 that in all of New York City, there were no more than 3 or 4 rabbis with the highest level of ordination. At this time, New York City was the largest Jewish community in the world. Rabbis were not paid well, and they were actually paid, if you want to get a good job in Klei Kodesh, you become a chazan as opposed to a rabbi. The cantors were paid well. Again, because East European Jews were not, because they didn't pay for rabbis. Because in Eastern Europe, who paid for the rabbis? The state did. In Eastern Europe, the rabbis serve particular communities. Whereas in the United States, the rabbis are expected to meet the needs of synagogue members who pay their salaries. And also, the egalitarian ideal undermined the deferential structure that Jews had once accepted towards rabbinical leadership. And basically now Jews can practice religion without rabbinic intrusion. And this led to basically many boorish and unlearned individuals who usurped rabbinical prerogatives. Many people, let's say, they set up shop as teachers, preachers, moalim, shochtim, right? There were no standards. In Eastern Europe, basically, there was more piety. There was also fear of disclosure. And that generally prevented abuse and preparation and sale of kosher meat. But the United States, with the collapse of religious life and the absence of community controls, cases of fraud multiplied. According to a 1915 estimate, only 40% of retail butchers who claimed to sell kosher meat were in fact doing so. So, of course, this leads to you think they're cynicism about kashrus now. But in 1915, there's always the challenge. In 1915, this leads to a great degree of cynicism and abandonment of dietary laws altogether, because people think it's a joke. Shabbos observance also declines because there's a condition of employment, because the condition, if you want to work in the cigar trade, clothing trade, on farms, or peddling, you have to work on Shabbos. Sunday closing laws were strictly enforced, so the employers said, if you don't come in on Saturday, don't bother coming in on Monday. It seems that most immigrants chose economics over religion, although some still remain Shomer Shabbos. Again, it's hard to know exact numbers, but a large majority of East European immigrant Jews did not affiliate with the synagogue either. So what's the Orthodox going to do? So some successful Orthodox businessmen, such as Draymond Jones, Jonas Weil, and Henry Chuck, look to improve the image and character of Jewish life. Therefore, they caused the oldest and wealthiest East European synagogues, Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, Oiv Tzedek, and Kahal Adas Yeshurum, to move into beautiful new synagogues in the mid 1880s, and they worked on improving decorum and appearance. There was this major cantor craze in the 1880s when the first $1,000 cantors were higher in the Lower East Side. And then Kahal Adat Yeshurun shocked the establishment by hiring Reverend Pinchas Minkowski for the sum of $5,000 per year. Shocked the establishment. And synagogues followed each other in hiring high-priced cantors. And tickets to attend services more than covered the cantors' high salaries. The cantors substituted the organ music that was playing in the Reformed temples. And they had the organ, they weren't going to play that, but they had these beautiful cantors. The cantors became superstars because they represented tradition, modernity, religious spirituality, and worldly success. And they represented a shift, but it was an important shift, from participation to performance in East European Jewish immigrant worship. Because basically you're coming not to participate in liturgy, I mean, you're saying the words, but it's all about listening, right, to the great performance. And this, by the way, was to some extent a continuation of the dream of Isaac Leeser, maybe 20, 30 years ago, to produce a Hirschian orthodoxy in America. So what about schools? So the first Jewish day school was established in 1731, by New York's Sephardic congregation, Sheirit Yisrael. A number of schools were opened by German Jews who immigrated to the United States after the failure of Europe's liberal revolution. In 1854, seven synagogues in New York conducted day schools with 35 teachers and 857 students. By 1860, all were closed, and the children had shifted, for the most part, to public schools. But with the growing importance of secular education in America through the 19th century, the Hebrew component of the Jewish day school curriculum was steadily reduced. German Jews especially established Jewish schools as a means of integrating into American life, not to preserve Jewish tradition. And so what happened was, by 1860, these day schools disappeared. Uptown Jews who were wealthy, they would hire tutors who would tutor kids in Hebrew. Machzike Talmud Torah opened in 1883, but it was only an afternoon Hebrew school, serving East European Jews in New York for several years. This was the first day school outside New York. Sorry, the first day school outside New York City was not established until 1917 in Baltimore. The cost for Machzike Talmud Torah was a whopping 10 cents per week. By 1910, there are 24 Talmud Torahs in New York, serving over 10,000 students. And in that year, the Talmud Torah achieved a new level of stature when it was designated the mainstay of Jewish education in America by the newly established Jewish Board of Education. Students attended classes 4 to 8 p.m. every afternoon, Monday through Thursday, and on Sunday mornings. There were a number of cheders, these one-room schools, which unfortunately had a very negative impact on thousands of young immigrant Jews. There's a record of there being like 251 kids in one room, in these one-room schools. Or I'm sorry, my mistake. There were about 251 of these cheders in the East Side in 1890, but like, you know, they weren't viewed as modern, as being part of the system, and a lot of kids were turned off by this, yeah?
That was Talmud Torah, of course, a lot were damaged
had
they not been a Talmud Torah.
You mean the Cheder or the Talmud Torah?
Both. Because most of the Cheder is because the teachers in Europe had to be respected for their learning. And right. In the United States, they were in a very poor paying job because they couldn't get and a very low paying job. And their manuscript was bitter.
Right.
And that was conveyed, that bitterness was being conveyed in what they were teaching these kids.
Correct.
And so these kids said, this is why I associate this. These people are so bitter.
Right. Right, right. You know, it was the cheders were often established in dark and unsanitary apartments by the poor. It was led often by unqualified teachers. Maybe they wanted to be Shomer Shabbos, the only job they can get. And like you mentioned, they turned a lot of kids off to Judaism. For many in the Orthodox community, the Talmud Torah, like the cheder, was also inadequate because it was a supplementary educational institution beginning after the public school day. And the cheder only taught a mechanical reading knowledge of Hebrew. And it became essentially an institution directed towards preparing the student for bar mitzvah. And once they're done, it's over. The intensive study of the Gemara, you know, that type of education was unavailable in the United States at this point until the creation of the yeshiva. So in 1886, Eitz Chaim, an elementary yeshiva was opened on the Lower East Side. It set Talmud study as its core curriculum. It taught state-mandated subjects from 4 p.m. and onward. So it's like our modern-day yeshiva. You had Muni Kodesh in the morning, and it goes till 4, I guess. And 4 and on, they would study secular studies. Happened to be the most renowned student would be Mordechai Kaplan. But okay. By 1900, there were 80 students and a building on Henry Street. By 1905, there were 150 students in 6 classes. The students here covered the public school curriculum sufficiently to enter City College of New York. Now, Jewish Theological Seminary, JTS. JTS opens its doors on January the 2nd, 1887. I have here the source sheet, the preamble and constitution of JTS. This is May 9th, 1886. The necessity having been made manifest for associated and organized effort in the past of the Jews of America faithful to Mosaic laws and ancestral traditions. Okay, so this is for this seminary. It is for Jews who are faithful to Mosaic law and ancestral traditions. So far, so good for us, no? For the purpose of keeping alive the true Judaic spirit. Right, so far, so good. Right, in particular, the establishment of a seminary where the Bible shall be impartially taught, rabbinical literature faithfully expounded, and more especially where youth desirous of entering the ministry may be thoroughly grounded in Jewish knowledge and inspired by the precept and example of their instructors with the love of Hebrew language, spirit of fidelity and devotion to the Jewish law. Do the scribes have? They've adopted a resolution in 5646, January 31st, 1886. At the synagogue Sherit Israel, so it was at an Orthodox synagogue, one second, agreed to organize the Jewish Theological Seminary, and they said the name is Jewish Theological Seminary. I wrote here Article 2nd, the purpose is the preservation in America of the knowledge and practice of historical Judaism, as ordained in the law of Moses, expounded by the prophets and sages of Israel in biblical and Talmudical writings. It proposed in furtherance of its general aim, the establishment and maintenance of a seminary for the training of rabbis and teachers. I mean, this sounds pretty orthodox, I guess. Yeah, Mandy, you had a question.
There's one word in this that stands out for me that seems loaded for some reason. The word impartially. It should be impartially taught. What is
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Do you know what that's supposed to mean?
I know, I don't. I was actually just reading this again.
Chosen word.
Yeah, that should be impartially taught. I wonder, I don't know if it's, yeah, I don't know. I hear what you're saying. It's opening it up to something.
I don't know.
It's a good question. It's a good question. I have different theories. I have to look out. I'll see if I can find something on that. It's a great question. I don't know the answer to the question. Yes, I'm wondering, is this Bible, right, in other words, are they in favor of Bible criticism? Then would that be, that right? Right, that would be the question. Would this be something that would be offensive to Orthodox tradition? Right, I don't know, I hear the question, yeah. We'll get there. So first, Torah, I'm going to talk about why you. We're going to go in yours. JTS was first, okay? Again, you have Eitz Chaim. No, you have Eitz Chaim, which is 1886. That seems to be like a regular yeshiva day school. And then you have this JTS. Now, the prominent Sephardic Jews, like Reverend Sabato Moreas of Mikveh Yisrael, Reverend Henry Pereira Mendes of Sherit Yisrael, there were many synagogues whose congregants loved tradition, but did not observe it, were in favor. There were these middle ground rabbis, Alexander Kohat, Marcus Jastrow. Many early supporters of JTS were Orthodox. Dr. Mendes, he was born in 1852, died in 1937. He was in like an early model for the modern Orthodox Jew. He was steeped in tradition in his father's London home. He had the piety of an East European Jew, but he took a degree in medicine at a secular institution. He worked actively with non-Orthodox Jews and non-Jewish clergy, and he participated in many communal and public activities in the general New York community. Therefore, he is what I would refer to as a early modern Orthodox Jew. The rabbis strongly disagreed among themselves concerning issues of religious tradition and change. For example, mixed seating was a big question. But in the wake of reforms, extreme radicalism, they focused on what united them. In the first 15 years following its opening, they had a shoestring budget. They graduated 14 rabbis and 3 cantors. A number of East European Jews contributed financially to JTS, including Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, who was the chief rabbi of New York from in the late 1880s. However, there was not complete support from the Orthodox movement. Some consider it insufficiently Orthodox. In 1898, in an effort to strengthen the traditional coalition, some of the leaders of JTS, including Dr. Mendes, Cyrus Adler, Bernard Drachman, and Max Cohen, joined together with leading East European Jews and 47 congregations to establish what they called the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, later to be called the OU. It comes into existence to protest against halachic statements by the Reform rabbis not in accord with the teachings of the Torah. This I have the principles adopted by the OU in 1898. Right, so you see this is a conference of delegates from the United States and Dominion of Canada. We're established not as a synod, and therefore we have no legislative authority to amend religious questions. We are simply a representative body. We believe in the divine revelation in the Bible. We declare that the prophets in no way discountenance ceremonial duty, but only condemn the personal life of those who observe ceremonial law, but disregard the moral. In other words, if you look, the Reform movement argued that if you look at the Nevi'im, like biblical Judaism, it's all about what? The Nevi'im mostly protest against acting, you're doing all these rituals, but you're not behaving morally. So the Reform movement said, we see that ritual is irrelevant, all we care about is moral. And they're saying, no, the Nevi'im were criticizing those who only kept ritual, didn't keep moral, but you have to do both. Ceremonial law is not optative, it is obligatory. All right, we affirm our adherence to the codes of our rabbis and the 13 principles of the Rambam. We believe in our dispersion, we are united with our brethren of alien faith in all that devolves upon men as citizens. But religiously, right, we have to say that we are separate in accordance with divine declaration. Also, we believe in the coming of a personal Messiah. We protest against the admonition of converts without milah and tefillah. We protest against intermarriage. And we believe that restoration to Zion is a legitimate aspiration of scattered Israel in no way conflicts with our loyalty to the United States of America. Now, this platform was essentially a point-by-point refutation of the Pittsburgh platform that the Reform Movement established. I spoke about it last lecture, where they basically said these are the principles of faith of the Reform Movement, and their platform was saying, no, this is where we disagree. And Mendes was the first president of the OU. The OU sought to support kashrus observance wherever possible. They urged college boards and boards of examiners to accommodate Shabbos observance. They vigorously support Zionism. They encourage state and local employers to provide leaves of absence to Jewish workers on Jewish holidays. They make traditional ceremonial objects more easily available. They battle missionaries, and they emphasize Shabbos observance. But again, this is a lay organization, right? JTS trains rabbis. Right, you need sort of like three systems, at least three systems. You need a lay organization, you need a seminary to train rabbis, and you need Jewish education, right? So you need all three. Now, most of the Orthodox congregations that founded the OU were small, poorly organized, and in desperate need of secular and religious leadership, and they only represented a small minority of Orthodox congregations. Now, the OU was different than JTS. If you were around in the 1890s, you might think OU, JTS, I'm a member of both. There are some differences, but some didn't focus on the differences. But the OU was different than JTS. It was less inclusive than JTS. The OU did not employ the word conservative in official publications. Its founders included no known rabbis of Reform synagogues. The seminary believed in an American Judaism comprised of two broad wings, a traditional one and one that's Reform, and the goal was to strengthen the traditional wing. Solomon Schachter, so he arrives in the United States on April 17th, 1902. He brings JTS back to life. He was considered the greatest English-speaking scholar of his day. He had vast rabbinic learning. He had traditional ordination. He had the best secular education and training that European universities could provide. He had a doctorate. He left Cambridge University to assume the helm of JTS, which he looked to transform into a center of Jewish education. He hoped that he could revitalize, or the hope would be that he would revitalize JTS, and funds were raised for JTS in advance of his arrival. He enhanced his fame with a series of remarkable discoveries based on long-lost fragments, which he identified and recovered from the Cairo Geniza, right? A storehouse for discarded Jewish artifacts, some 1,000 years old. Initially, Solomon Schachter sought to embrace everything to the right of the Reform Movement. And therefore, the OU marched hand in hand with him for a time. Within a few years, there was a beautiful new building near Columbia. It boasted America's finest Jewish library, a world-class scholarly faculty, and more than 100 students. Even though Solomon Schachter opposed most of what the Reform Movement stood for, and he worked to undermine it, he nevertheless believed in cooperating with the Reform Jews in areas connected with Jewish learning, communal welfare, and social justice. Additionally, and it should also be noticed, it also be noted that the reorganization of JTS was financed largely by affluent Reform Jews, who believe there's a value to this as well. So, you know, when you pay for something, there also has always some amount of influence. The great concern among Orthodox immigrants was that students of JTS studied very little Talmud and codes in Jewish law. At this time, essentially, most of the Orthodox Jewish community, you know, they didn't study a lot of Gemara, and they studied about it. There wasn't a heavy emphasis on Gemara study or in Halacha. At this time, most of the organized Jewish community thought that eventually American Judaism would be split into two major wings. Each had its own seminary. You had Hebrew Union College for the Reform and JTS, everything to the right of Reform. You had two congregational unions, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, that's with Hebrew Union College, and the OU with the JTS. And then you had the Rabbinical Association, you had the Central Conference of American Rabbis created in 1889, and you had an alumni association of JTS. So because Myrna asked about YU, let's talk about YU. Reitz, yeah.
Okay, Mr. Why did the name conservative as a part of Judaism come into play. So far, you think about JTS, sounds like you could say it was Orthodox.
No, so they include, I don't know the exact date. If you probably look at it, it's probably the late 1880s, like right at the late 1880s, 1890s. So they said it a little bit here and there, but it wasn't... Well, it's interesting. In the document, it doesn't seem that they have the word conservative. But eventually, it's hard. I have to study that. It's a very good question. It seems like it evolved. I think like some people, it's like start speaking about it, and then eventually some people focus on the difference. You have centrist orthodoxy in our world, modern orthodoxy. You have open orthodoxy. So like some of these terms are colloquially used until at some point it becomes.
Sorry.
Yeah, to conserve Judaism more so. Right. Right, right. Right. So the question is that the same thing as Orthodox or not? What does that mean? Right. So now, perhaps in response to the lack of representation of right-wing rabbinic organization in the United States, 60 European trained rabbis who represented Judaism's right wing convened on July 29th, 1902, the day of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's funeral, and 100 days following Solomon Schechter's arrival, and they created the Agudas HaRabbonim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. They talked in Yiddish, and they wrote in Hebrew. Their issues were Jewish education. My thing is going to... it's the problem. What's the closest outlet? I didn't know how this would work. Sorry. But I don't want to make everyone move. Sorry. Right when we begin to talk about why you, the power goes out. Okay. Yeah. 1887. Okay, good. So late 1880s. Yeah, good. Thank you. What?
It was used at the dedication.
Oh, yeah? Okay. But it's interesting. It's not in the preamble. That's interesting. We're with you. So we're talking about 1902. They form Agudas HaRabbonim, a union of Orthodox rabbis, okay? And their focus is Jewish education, observance of Shabbos and Kashrus, Jewish marriage and divorce. And their goal is they want to improve religious instruction. They only want observant Jews, observant teachers in the Cheder. They want to create careful records of marriage and divorce. They want to wage war against Orthodox Shabbos violators in the marketplace. People say, I'm Orthodox, but I'm publicly Michal Shabbos. And they want to establish an inspection system of kashrus and mikvahs. They want to create standards to raise the level of traditional Judaism. Now, only rabbis from East European yeshivos were included for membership. In other words, if you're a graduate of JTS, or you're a graduate from Western European rabbinical seminaries, you weren't included. Okay. Now, most of the rabbis, at the inception of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, were largely from Kovna, largely ordained from Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. They advocate Yiddish as the preferred language of instruction in Jewish schools. Now, what's interesting is they adopt religious Zionist positions early on. At the 1904 convention, there were memorial services at a local shul for Theodor Herzl. Again, they weren't committed to Zionism, but to religious Zionism. They promoted the fledgling Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary Reitz. It was founded in 1897 by associates of Rav Yaakov Yosef to serve as an American counterpart of the finest yeshivos in Eastern Europe. And the focus of study in Reitz was Talmud and its commentaries. It's a traditional East European, curriculum. The students, who was going to read at that time? They were graduates of Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, the day school there, or one of the European counterparts. The founder of the school, Rav Moshe Matlin, he was a father of a graduate of Eitz Chaim, anxious to provide his son additional training in Gemara. Now, when the Reitz was founded, the goal was not to produce rabbis. The goal was simply Torah Lishma, Torah for its own sake, to learn. And there was an agreement with the Agudas HaRabbanim in 1984 that stipulated, if a student wished smicha, they wanted to get smicha, then the Agudas HaRabbanim, the rabbis there would test the potential candidate, and then if the student passed, he would receive ordination. But it wasn't like now, we view Reitz, that's where, you know, students finish. Some students just study at Reitz, they don't get smicha, but mostly it's, you go to Reitz, you can get smicha. Originally, that wasn't the goal. The goal was simply Torah Lishma. People study in Velashin, and they study in the Mir, and they Slobodka, they're studying because they just want to learn. So this is also originally Torah Lishma. Now, the Reitz's certificate of incorporation stated that the purpose of the school was to educate and prepare students of the Hebrew faith for the Orthodox ministry, yet clearly the intention of the school was Torah Lishma. The Agudas HaRabbanim established a smicha board at Reitz while publicly dismissing as unqualified the rabbis of JTS. The school memorialized the distinguished Talmudist and spiritual leader of Kovna Jewry, Rav Yitzchak Inspector, who died in 1896. He gave smicha to Rabbi Matlin. So it's no wonder that this theological seminary was called the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. That's Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, Inspector of Kovna. Now, the Agudas HaRabbanim at its 1903 convention in Philadelphia recognized Reitz as the only legitimate yeshiva in the United States of America. However, it recognized Reitz as the only legitimate yeshiva in the United States of America. That is, they're saying like the JTS is not considered legitimate. How? Yeah.
JTS already shifting from the traditional roots
of that. So a little bit. I mean, again, it's hard to know exactly. Again, it wasn't a heavy Talmud, you know, intense. It was like that kind of study. So they felt, yeah, for the most part, they're Orthodox. Again, like there are some disputes about, you know, mixed seating, and there's a wide variety in terms of, and we're going to see some of the issues that come up. So the seminary, however, does not evolve or develop as the Agudas HaRabbanim had hoped. During the early years of the 20th century, the students publicly protested against rules that deprived them of stipends if they pursued secular studies. I don't know if any of you are aware that there are students at YU now that they go to college. This wasn't initially. It was initially, you go to Reitz, it's only, you want to get a stipend? No, you don't attend secular college. As early as 1901, students began to complain about Reitz's spotty fulfillment of its pledge to provide instruction in English language, and the board of directors was divided over its response. In other words, you see what's going on. In other words, you have certain, in the founding of Reitz, you have certain members who support it. They want to take Velazhin or Slobodka and just transplant it to YU. And meanwhile, some of the students are saying, but we want to remain firm. We want to learn Gemara intensively and learn the codes intensively, but we want a good education. Between 1906 and 1908, there were well-publicized strikes over the curriculum, including training in the art of the sermon. were debated, so that the Reitz graduates, they wanted to compete with, you know, they were still competing with the JTS graduates. They could tell a shul, well, I know Maseches Bava Metzia by heart, the Bava Basra, and like your average Bala Basra is like, well, can you deliver a nice drasha? So they want to be able to compete, right? So 15 students who were most vocal in their demands for a strong secular program were dropped from the stipend rolls in 1908. But the Jewish press of New York was firmly behind the students, so Reitz directors gave in after only 3 weeks. Students were readmitted and a new curriculum of secular studies was taught. Additionally, while a new curriculum was being worked out, students would be permitted to attend other schools for their secular education. There was also a curriculum was being worked out to provide instruction for those students wanting to attend the Orthodox ministry. So again, there are two different goals here. Now you have one goal of students, they want secular education. And you have another goal of people who are saying, well, I'm learning all this Torah. I want to do this as professionally. I need to be trained in this. So Rabbi Moshe Margulies, who was gradually becoming the leader of the American Orthodox rabbi, he was the rabbi of KJ, Kilat Yeshurun, starting in 1906. He becomes the president of this institution of Reitz, and the students saw in him an enlightened leader who would make substantive changes. However, their first mostly cosmetic changes, and no new curriculum emerged. Therefore, enrollment falls alarmingly until the school was reorganized by Rabbi Bernard Dov Revel, who becomes president in 1915. He was ordained at the age of 16. He also undertook secular studies. He arrives in America in 1906, where he studied at Reitz and at Temple University, New York University, and Dropsy College, where he earned his PhD in 1911. So here was someone. He has a smicha from an Eastern European yeshiva, and he has a doctorate from an American university. What better candidate than someone to lead Reitz and yeshiva? He was close with the Agudas Rabbanim. He served as an assistant to the president of Gluzer Bonnie, Rabbi Bernard Leventhal, and he was also close with more modern Jewish scholars who taught him at Dropsy College. He also became financially independent, marrying into America's wealthiest East European Orthodox immigrant families, the Travis family, and he was brought into the family business. In 1915, Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and Reitz merge. And the director of Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and Reitz invited him in 1915 to reorganize and lead their newly merged institution. His goal was not transplantation. His goal was translation. That's a term I heard from Rabbi Rakefet. He was in favor, I think he said with respect to maybe Rabbi Soloveitchik, but the same idea. Like, no, it's not about transplantation. We're not taking Eastern Europe and just moving it, you know, to a new location. We are translating the values of Eastern Europe into translating, into adapting it into the United States. He was in favor of teaching secular studies, and students were not discouraged to attend college. He tries to attract Shomer Shabbos faculty in 1918. Half of the Jewish studies faculty were practicing Orthodox Jews who boasted doctoral degrees from secular colleges. His first step in reorganizing this new institution was the creation of the first high school in America under Jewish auspices. He created the Talmudical Academy, which opened its doors September 3rd, 1916, with an enrollment of approximately 20 students. Students would study secular subjects between 3:30 and 7 p.m. By 1921, the student body had grown to over 200, and 2 years later, it would reach 400, taught by a faculty of 20. He also brought the leading minds of the generation to serve at the Rosh Yeshiva. In 1922, he brought over Rav Shlomo Polachek, the Machesor Eloi. Unfortunately, though, he passed away in 1928. So Rav Shimon Shkop becomes a temporary Rosh Yeshiva in 1929, but he wanted to return to Europe. So with the arrival of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of the Rav, at the end of summer of 1929, Rav Shimon Shkop returns to Europe. In 1923, Rabbi Revel plans to open a yeshiva college, which would add to the elementary school, the high school, teachers' institute, and theological seminary. It resulted in an unprecedented $5 million campaign to create a prominent campus in Washington Heights. It seems that Revel simply viewed this college as an opportunity to provide general academic training to those who are studying in other departments of the yeshiva, but some viewed yeshiva as a school to cater to Jews who were barred from Christian schools for non-scholastic reasons. Now, Rabbi Revel was able to create this mainstream institution because he was connected to everyone. He was connected to East European rabbis. He had extensive Torah learning, and he was politically savvy. Yeshiva created a group of Americanized Orthodox rabbis and a large alumni of Jewishly Orthodox laymen, which would become known as, some call it, modern Orthodoxy. Now, even though Revel was originally supported by the Agudas HaRabbanim, eventually there was opposition because of the academic freedom that exists in the university. Additionally, he offered honorary degrees to non-firm Jews, like someone you may have heard of, Albert Einstein. Also, advanced academics took away time from the study of Torah. For the Rabbanim of the Agudas HaRabbanim, there was too much of a collegiate atmosphere. Additionally, some non-Orthodox students were also being sent to the yeshiva. Additionally, there became a rivalry that developed between older Yiddish-speaking rabbis and these young American rabbis who went to Ritz. The Agudas HaRabbanim wanted more of a say in the running of the yeshiva. And for example, they tried to convince Revel not to reopen the college for the academic year of 32-33 to help cut down expenses. However, most Americanized Orthodox Jews looked upon the college as a symbol that reflected the ability to be Orthodox and cultured in America, and that this could keep the next generation of American Jews in the fold. So now, this was all an introduction to our topic today. Don't worry that long. But so this lead, now we move on to parting of ways between the Orthodox and conservative movements. We had to sort of set out the lay of the land. Now, during the interwar years, some synagogues like the Brooklyn Jewish Center and Congregation Adas Israel in Cincinnati were identified both as conservative and Orthodox in the eyes of their members. Additionally, JTS and Yeshiva were both experiencing financial difficulties. So in 1926, a serious effort takes place to effect a merger between JTS and Yeshiva College. Now, JTS was in favor, and some lay leaders of Yeshiva gave it serious consideration. But Revel and his mentors from the Agudas HaRabbanim were opposed. So why is that? If you look, just I brought here in the handout, this is a letter from Max. So here is a letter from Max Straub to Cyrus Adler, March 15th, 1926. So we're going to see who each one is. Look what he writes here. Dear Dr. Adler, at the meeting yesterday, I did not care to explain. Now, Max Straub was the JTS graduate, and he was the president of the Rabbinical Assembly from 1925 to 1927. And he said, he writes this letter to Cyrus Adler. He was the chancellor of JTS. So he's one JTS, I guess, board member or board leader to the chancellor of JTS. I do not care to explain in detail my reasons for being absolutely convinced that the proposed union between seminary and the yeshiva will never be consummated. I therefore consider it my duty to point out to you those things which will make it impossible, the union of the two institutions. So he says, number one, curriculum. The yeshiva group would insist upon a curriculum which would grant the Hataras Hara'ah, in other words, traditional ordination granted for proficiency in the codes and ability to decide ritual questions to each graduate. You need a higher level of smicha. This curriculum would mean that in the future, men of the type of Jacob Cohen, Israel Goldstein, Norman Salid, Elias Salmu will be kept out of the ministry. Personally, with all my desire to see an American clergy that is able to decide ritual questions, I would any day prefer Jacob Cohen to T.S., I'm not sure what T.S. is. But basically saying that the requirements for smicha were too great. The yeshiva group not only objects to our present curriculum, but to the method of instruction. It is opposed to historical method in teaching the Talmud and to any critical method of interpreting the Bible. Let's go back to your question, Mandy, about those, or what Howie also mentioned, what does it mean to impartially interpret the Bible? Even Professor Hoshender's conservative view is trafe to them. I don't know how we can recede from our conviction at this point. So number one is, our smicha requirements aren't rigorous enough. Number two, some of our instruction is considered heretical to them. Number three, the yeshiva group is opposed to sending rabbis to any but strictly Orthodox congregations. So therefore, we can't connect with the United Synagogue. Number four, the yeshiva group considers the Teachers Institute the citadel of atheism because it is headed by Professor Mordechai Kaplan. Under no condition will they countenance a union with the seminary as long as he is retained on the faculty. I spoke to the most liberal mind of the group, and they tell me that this is the crux of the entire problem. Can we afford to have Kaplan again brought up for discussion? Are we ready to eliminate him? Okay. So you're saying that's obviously an issue. And then I also have this letter from Rabbi Moshe Margolis. Right, he's the senior rabbi of KJ, to Mr. Levy. So he's a prominent rav in Philadelphia. He's a mentor to Revel, very involved in the YU. He says, for the reason I've discussed with you, a conference seemed to serve no purpose. Rabbi Leventhal confirms this impression after the informal talk with Dr. Adler that was suggested at your house by saying there's neither desire on their part nor a common basis on which amalgamation of the two institutions could be discussed. Such a conference, which cannot lead to any results, will not make the relations between the two institutions more friendly. If you still feel there may be some purpose, okay, then I'll meet with you. It'll be inconvenient for us to meet sooner. So basically, he thinks it's not a good idea to meet. In other words, basically, the major issues was that JTS students learned far less Gemara and Halacha than YU. They learned about Talmud. Yeshiva students study the Talmud. Biggest issue, as I mentioned, was Mordechai Kaplan teaching homiletics. He wasn't Orthodox. His father was in Rav Yaakov Yosef's Beis Din, but he withdrew from his Orthodox philosophy after his father died. The truth is that the goals of Yeshiva and JTS were different. And Revel understood this. Some of his, perhaps the lady, didn't understand, but he understood this. The goal of JTS was training rabbis and teachers. The Yeshiva's goal was the education, actually, of a dedicated laity in addition to rabbis and teachers. And even after the failed merger, there was overlap. For example, in 1938, five of JTS's eight ordinees had spent time in yeshiva, and well into the 1950s, 20 to 30% of JTS's rabbinical students actually graduated from yeshiva. And at least 60% of JTS graduates came from Orthodox backgrounds. The United Synagogue of America, founded in 1913, listed among its objectives the maintenance of Jewish tradition in its historical community, loyalty to the Torah and its historical exposition, and observance of Shabbos and dietary laws, preserving the traditional character of the liturgy and establishment of Jewish religious schools. Both conservative and modern Orthodox movements in the 1920s used the same language. They would both be speaking about how do we deal with indifference and apathy among Jewish youth. We have to make Jewish religion more meaningful to modern American life. Initially, there are these small differences, but eventually they widen into large ones. The creation of the United Synagogue did much to further this parting of the ways. This was spurred on from Solomon Schechter because JTS had financial problems. So basically, you had the Union of American Hebrew College. They are raising funds to support Hebrew Union College. And OU, right, even though OU and JTS were sort of connected initially a little bit, or members of connected, eventually, OU is basically supporting REITs and not really JTS. They were reluctant to support innovations by JTS rabbis in a bid to attract young people. Eventually, the ideological gap between OU synagogues with JTS rabbis, got larger and larger. And there was a big debate as to what to call this new congregation organization. Eventually, they wanted to be called the United Synagogue, because the goal, they thought, conservative Judaism was the future of all Jews. So they said, we're going to call it the United Synagogues. They wanted to marginalize those on the left and those on the right. But eventually, it actually wasn't until 1991 that they realized, yeah, we're not going to attract everyone. So they changed their name to United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. But initially, it was called United Synagogue, because they thought that conservative was going to be able to attract everyone. Now, there were two issues. This is what I'll finish with. There are two issues that helped permanently separate the conservative and Orthodox Judaism. First issue is the Aguna issue. There was a major problem after World War I's missing soldiers and immigration. Rabbi Louis Epstein, who was a graduate of JTS, he had studied in Slobodka Yeshiva, so he's a big Talmud Chacham. He put forth a proposal tentatively approved by the Rabbinical Seminary in 1935. I wrote it. We're not going to read it inside, but I wrote the. I brought a handout which sort of describes what is he describing. He said you should add a provision to the ksuva, which would, under special circumstances, empower a wife to write her own bill of divorce that he hoped would be acceptable to Orthodox rabbis worldwide. So this proposal, that's a topic we can have a lecture unto itself, it's different proposals to deal with the Aguda crisis. But this particular proposal was blasted by the Orthodox and the Agudas Rabbanim, with Revel as a signatory, published a scathing response called Lidor Acharon, and they agreed to excommunicate anyone involved in a Jewish wedding ceremony performed following this type of divorce. The issue, again, I'm not going to get into a whole large discussion about this because it's more of a history lecture, and we've gone a long time. But the issue, essentially, is that the husband could always cancel his wife as an agent. You serve at the ksuva, you're appointing your wife as an agent. The reason why it's not such a great solution is because the husband can cancel his wife as an agent during the duration of the marriage. There's also a question if the husband sort of writes a get, and or like is it writes a get for the future, and then he's intimate with his wife, does that really cancel out your desire to create the get? So there were a lot of halachic issues. Maybe it's maybe a topic of a further discussion. But in any case, that was sort of one issue that really separated Orthodox and conservative movement. And the second issue was mixed seating. In the second half of the 19th century, reformers abandoned traditional separation of men and women in the synagogue. And now, in the beginning of the 20th century, JTS-trained rabbis considered this possibility. Many JTS professors were opposed, but the rabbis in the field put pressure on the leadership because they thought it was necessary. Some shuls provided three sections, men, women, and mixed. By 1941, the Law Committee of Conservative Rabbinical Assembly recognized that it's difficult to maintain the machitza in the synagogue, and by 1947, it was confirmed that mixed seating was the general practice in nearly all conservative congregations. Numerous Rietz rabbis also served in mixed seating congregations, especially as new suburban synagogues opened in the 1950s. Many Orthodox synagogues had family seating as well. There is an estimate in 1954 that 90% of graduates of the Skokie Yeshiva, or as they say, the Yeshiva, and 50% of the graduates of Rietz had rabbinic positions where family seating or optional family seating was available. However, Orthodox leaders never agreed with this innovation. The yeshiva sometimes revoked the ordination of graduates if they continued to serve mixed seating congregations after having been warned to leave them. Revel, when he was president, of yeshiva from 1920s until his death in 1940s, did not permit the yeshiva to agree to a congregation introducing mixed pews. He insisted that the machitza tradition be retained in the synagogue. If a yeshiva rabbinical graduate was to occupy its pulpit. There were instances, though, when Revel did permit a graduate to be interviewed by a congregation with mixed pews, but only if the shul already had mixed pews, and he felt the rabbi could bring them back to the fold, and he had sort of like 1 year to install machitza, and then Revel would say, you have to leave. Usually wasn't so successful. The Young Israel movement, which was founded in 1912, stipulated in its constitution that it would revoke the charter of any member congregation that had mixed seating. The OU and the RCA also publicly denounced mixed seating, but they did not sanction individual members who behaved otherwise. Additionally, there are well-publicized court cases in the 1950s that provided Orthodox leaders with a forum for denouncing mixed seating as incompatible with Orthodoxy. The courts would generally not get involved in a dispute. But the point was that because of this litigation, it became clear, and certainly by the 1950s, that a true Orthodox synagogue is one without mixed seating. Now some synagogues tried to find a middle ground. They were called the traditional, and they tried to reconcile Orthodoxy with mixed seating. In conclusion, what is obvious to us now in 2023 was not obvious to all 100 years ago. There was still some hope that an enlightened Orthodoxy can find common ground and perhaps even unite with JTS at a time when the rabbinic leaders were more aligned halachically with the Orthodox movement than they currently are. However, many rabbinic leaders of YU, including Rabbi Revel, understood that there was a profound difference between JTS and Rietz. And sometimes you see small differences, but the question is, do they reflect broader philosophical differences, which will only increase with the passage of time? And Rabbi Revel and other leaders understood that there was a profound difference between JTS and Rietz in terms of approach, the type of shiurim, the faculty, the accommodationist attitude towards sending rabbis to non-Orthodox congregations, among other issues. These issues were minor issues, open to discussion, as I mentioned, but they reflected a different worldview. Just because both JTS and Rietz say, oh, both are institutions that are open to the modern world and modern methods in dealing with a new type of Jew, the American Jew, the Rietz approach, at the end of the day, was far too traditional for the approach of JTS. The Rietz approach still felt connected to the East European yeshivos and the methodology of Psak, and the Aguna issue, And the Mechitza issue separated these movements completely. In our final session that we're going to have at some point, like next month, we will outline the different approaches between the dream of YU and Rabbi Soloveitchik versus the dream of Lakewood, Rav Aaron Cutler, and how they reflected two different approaches within the Orthodox camp, which was now, at this time in the 1950s, fully separate from the conservative and reform movements.